This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, the 1960 U2 incident and a son's search for the truth. But first, do you remember a time when a bank savings account earned about 5% interest each year? It's quite a contrast from today, with savings accounts averaging just a little more than 0.5%. Series EE savings bonds return 0.1%, nowhere near enough to keep up with inflation. Other government bonds have higher rates, but still average about 2%. You can do better with high-yield bonds and the dividends paid on some stocks if you're willing to take the risks associated with those types of investments. And joining us to talk about navigating today's low-interest rate environment and getting the most from your income-generating investments are Greg Brown, income strategist with Oppenheimer Funds, and Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Greg and Chris, thank you for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to be here, Mark.
Thank you, Chris. And before we get started on our discussion, what are some of the numbers that we need to be keeping an eye on this week?
Well, it's earnings week now. Earnings are in full swing, and tomorrow is going to be a fairly busy day on the earnings calendar. There are a number of them, including, I believe, IBM, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Johnson & Johnson, Lockheed Martin. We talked about the U2. Lockheed Martin will be reporting tomorrow, American Express, U.S. Bank Corp on Wednesday. We get a Dow component, Visa, Microsoft, Travelers, and so on Thursday. General Electric, Honeywell, and Colgate-Palmolive on Friday. So it's a busy week for earnings.
Wow, it sounds
like lots of numbers.
At least a dozen you ran by.
And here we are today. You know, it's the 17th of July. Usually you have the summer doldrums, as they're called, but the market is just in full swing, closed at record highs on Friday, and those records are being pushed a little further. The Dow at this very moment is up about 17.5 points. The S&P is up 2.5, and the NASDAQ up over 10 points today. So just chugging right along.
Chugging right along. Didn't we get a look at the New York manufacturing numbers today, too?
You know, I didn't see that.
Okay.
I've been busy this morning.
I think they were up. They weren't as up as high as they were
in June. The Empire State Manufacturing Index.
Yeah. I think they were up about 9.8%, but compared to what they were up in June, they weren't up quite as much.
Yeah. So. These numbers, these various Fed numbers, the Philly Fed Index, the New York Index, they vary quite a bit from month to month. There's a lot of noise in them, and you always have to factor these things out. Greg, of course, as an income strategist, would know a lot about that because there are so-called high-frequency numbers that, you know, you get figures on every week or more often, and then there are the monthly numbers that people hover around the TV sets like Game of Thrones starting. You know, it's the employment numbers on Friday. So anyway, Greg, thanks for being here. You know, Greg, is your experience in the before you joined Oppenheimer as the income strategist, you were in the oil and gas pipeline business through a master limited partnership, publicly, and these weren't publicly traded, but they're MLP funds. So that's one kind of yield vehicle. What have you been seeing as the yields as the income strategist there at Oppenheimer? What have people been doing to kind of combat what the ill effects of what Mark Haney just described, namely practically zero interest, zero return on your savings?
Yeah, you know, those are interesting questions, and I hear that every week when I'm on the road from investors and from advisors. You know, where do I get the most bang for my buck for retirement income, or how do I set up my retirement income in the face of what looks like are going to be lower for longer long-term interest rates? So there's a lot of opportunities out there. I think the thing I really like investors to keep in mind are, you know, there's no free lunch when we talk about retirement income. So if we look at investment products or investment solutions or securities that have higher yields, they typically come with some additional risk. And you certainly want to be cognizant of those additional risks you might be taking on the balance sheets. But, you know, if we kind of set the stage right now, if you look at the U.S. 10-year, we're at 2.31% right now for 10-year treasuries. We're at 1.36 on the 2-year treasury. And if you go all the way out to 30 years, you know, the U.S. treasury is at 2.90 today, I believe. So those are not fantastic numbers. I know the three of us were talking just before we came on the air about when the passbook savings rates were at 5%. And that seems like a few lifetimes ago. But it really wasn't more than about 8 or 10 years back where you could get those kind of rates. So I hear every week, should I be in high yield bonds? Should I be in municipal bonds? You know, as you mentioned a minute ago, what about master limited partnerships in oil and gas pipelines? So there are a lot of places we can go right now, even senior floating rate funds, where we can get yields higher than those treasury rates, but they all come with an additional set of risks or concerns for investors or more importantly for retirees who want to, you know, protect that nest egg as long as they can.
And Greg, if you're looking out, you mentioned how we're probably going to be in this low interest rate environment for some time. Does anybody have any idea how long we might be in this?
No, but I can tell you that our chief investment officer and I, Krishnan Mamani, have a regular conversation. He came out with his first low for long on 10-year treasury rates white paper back in the second quarter of 2013. So we're 4 years into this already, and he would tell you, I'm 53 years old, he would tell you never again in my career lifetime would we see a 10-year treasury back at 5% in his opinion.
Okay, interesting. So the lower for longer argument is one goalpost. Now, the other goalpost right. is the argument that rates have been so low for so long that they have nowhere to go but up. The Fed's raising rates. One major firm last week even said that the Fed might raise 4 or 5 times next year. Is it possible then, Greg Brown from Oppenheimer, that the Fed can raise rates and on the Fed funds rate, but that the bond market can just ignore them or shrug their shoulders?
Yeah, you know, I have to take this Janet Yellen-led Fed at their word that they want to raise the short-term rates, and I would expect them to do that. We may see one or perhaps two more, you know, 25 basis point moves in the Fed funds rate this year, and I think all that will serve to do is flatten the yield curve in the short end, so raise the short end of the interest rate curve. But I could, you know, foresee the 10-year staying in this 2-something range and the 30-year, you know, continue to stay in a sub 3% range for quite some time to come. So I'll trust the Fed that they're going to move here a couple of times, you know, one or two more times this year and several times next year. But I think that doesn't necessarily affect the 10-year. And I think the last thing the Fed would want to do right now would be blow up mortgage rates or, you know, hurt housing starts or, you know, refi activity in this range. So, you know, will they move in the short term? Absolutely. Does that mean I'm going to look for a 5-year CD at 3-5%? I would think not.
Why is the Fed, why are they keeping rates so low? Is it because inflation is staying so low? Is that what's driving this?
Well, I think if you look at the Fed's mandate, you know, one half of it is inflation. And we saw June CPI numbers or June inflation numbers at around 1.7. You know, their target is about 2. So that's well in check. We've got unemployment in a reasonable range at about 4. And so, you know, if you ask this Fed, I think that they would tell you that things are chugging along at a reasonable pace, certainly not at a 3-5% as the previous or the current administration would like in terms of GDP. But I think they think we're doing okay. So I think in their minds, you know, we've been at low rates enough and the cost of capital has been low enough right now for industries that they feel like they need to put a few arrows back in the quiver, so to speak, in the unlikely event or in the event that they need them down the road. So it's a little bit of a misnomer. They say things are going well, but we better put some arrows in the quiver just in case.
Yeah. So, Greg, are you saying then that perhaps because inflation is so low that the Fed can afford to keep rates down, what role does the increased supply and availability of shale oil and natural gas have in keeping inflation low?
Yeah, well, I think it's a contributing factor. There were studies out more than a decade ago that said, you know, a 5 or 6 cent savings at the pump is better than most tax cuts for U.S. consumers. You know, unfortunately, as oil's come off from 100 down to 26 and then buoyed in here in the mid-40s right now, the chief beneficiaries have been, you know, monster energy drinks and fast food closest to where Americans fill their tanks.
Yeah.
And not translated into additional, you know, spending and additional consumption outside of a few of those narrow areas. But I think, you know, inexpensive shale oil has contributed to a low inflation number. And should for some time to come. You know, we've come off the bottom of something in the 300 perhaps rig count working in North America, and we're up over 935, maybe 940 rigs as of last week. You know, and we're not anywhere nearly back to $80, $90, $100 a barrel oil. So U.S. shale producers have proven very resilient and certainly kept costs down. I'm back in the Midwest this week, and I see gas for just over $2 a gallon, which is more than affordable for most consumers in the U.S. Yeah. And should continue.
So, Greg, let's talk about some ways people can get more bang for their buck. You mentioned high-yield bonds. Now, what's a high-yield bond, and who are those suitable for?
Yeah, you know, high-yield bonds are corporate bonds that are issued by companies that are not investment-grade, so double B and below credit quality. They tend to be risky, but they've had a very good run, especially with energy making up perhaps 17% of that index. So as we moved in energy up from 26 to something, you know, mid-40s right now, high yields had a very good run since February of a year ago. You know, they're appropriate for a small portion of a retiree or an income portfolio. My concern with high yield right now is that it's run pretty far, pretty fast here over the last year and a half or so. So you can see yields in the, you know, 6.5%+ range, but it seems like they've moved pretty dramatically over the last year. So it's appropriate for a small portion of a retiree's portfolio, but I'm a little concerned about high-yield corporate bonds and, you know, maturities in the 5, 6, 7, 8 year range right now in this environment. If you look at investment-grade companies rated better than double B, so triple B and above, investment-grade looks better, probably, you know, fully valued here for the most part, but you're getting yields in companies that have better balance sheets, better growth outlooks, lower cost of capital typically. So those look a little better than high yield right now, but I'd be a little concerned about, you know, dipping a toe into high yield right now if I didn't own it right now.
So more risk involved with that, and that's your concern.
Yeah, absolutely more risk, you know, narrower sources of revenue or sales, and typically higher cost of capital. So if the Fed, and I trust them that they're going to move rates up here, it can affect, you know, high yield companies much more dramatically than investment grade corporate bond issuers.
Greg, a lot of portfolio managers and investment professionals have recommend for most of their clients that you have a diversified portfolio using many people use something known as the efficient frontier, where you have investments that are, you know, that move in opposite directions of each other, so that you have one thing zigging while the other is zagging, and you end up with something that, as a portfolio, is less volatile. And one of the key components of that is to invest some of a portfolio internationally. When you look for income overseas, how are the best ways for the average person sitting in their living room or out there on their back deck at this very minute, what are some of the best ways to participate in that if you're not a professional in that industry?
Yeah, well, it's kind of tough to do to go out right now and buy, you know, international corporate bonds and figure that out on your own. So I think number one, having a good investment professional is key. I think number two, there are tremendous opportunities if we look forward in international fixed income. I think there's tremendous opportunities out there. Remember that the European Central Bank, led by Mario Draghi, is still easing at $60 billion a month. So they're still buying government debt, mortgages, and corporate debt through their programs right now at $60 billion per month. So that additional easing is making readily available capital to those companies and those sovereign entities, cash available for them to grow their balance sheets and stabilize their balance sheets. So I think that's a tremendous place to be right now. So I would prefer to participate either in some kind of a mutual fund or an ETF in that space and get some professional management. But I think access and international bonds and also emerging market local debt looks very attractive going forward. And I think both of those things are attractive for three reasons. Number one, we've got stable commodities going forward. There's very few analysts or folks out there saying oil is going back to 75, 80, 90 between now and 2022. So we've got stable commodities in there kind of across the board. Number two is tremendously larger growth opportunities from emerging market and international markets right now versus the U.S. and the economic cycle that we would view in the late, you know, bottom of the eighth inning, early ninth inning, to use a baseball analogy. And we've got a lot of growth coming from other parts of the country or other parts of the globe, where I think investors can find some better yields with some entities or some governments that are growing at better clips than the U.S. at, 1.7 inflation right now and maybe a 2% GDP this year. So I think that's a great point. Excellent opportunities abroad right now.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to talk about navigating today's low interest rate environment and getting the most from your income-generating investments are Greg Brown, income strategist with Oppenheimer Funds, and Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Greg, I was curious about passive investments in real estate, things like real estate investment trusts, how those are looking right now.
Yeah, real estate investment trusts look good right now. If your expectation is, 2.5% to maybe 4% yields right now, they look pretty good. I think international real estate investment, following up on our conversation there about international bonds, look better to me right now than domestic real estate investments. But yeah, I think REITs look good right now for yields, 260 to 4% in the U.S. and even higher than that abroad in developed Europe and developed Asia especially. So I think those are good opportunities for a small portion of a client's portfolio.
Now, Greg, do some of these real estate investment trusts or REITs as they're known come with any kind of tax, not so much time bombs, but tax nuisances where a portion of your income is sheltered because the real estate investment trust itself is taking depreciation, when you buy a new HVAC system for a building or there are different tax angles to some of these. Is that something that affects most investors, or are there ways to not have to worry about that and just focus on the asset and yield it themselves?
I think for the most part in the REIT mutual funds, if you participate at that level, most of that is all taken care of for you at the fund level. And investors don't have to worry about that for the most part. Depreciation from the new heating, air conditioning, from the additions, from the various build outs on the buildings. I don't think you have to worry about that in most cases for the end investors. It's handled at the fund level or at the investment level. So you don't have to worry about that at all.
Yeah, what we're trying to do, of course, is to prevent people from getting a K-1, one of the dreaded K-1 reports, who don't really
Correct.
Need to get a K-1.
A K-1 report.
A K-1. It's not a serial. It's a
There Unfortunately,
there are things such as a serial bond, but it's a different serial. A K-1 is a partnership tax reporting document that tells you what percentage of businesses, if you were in a partnership with somebody, what percentage of that you get to take on your return to offset the income. And some publicly traded entities actually do not use a Form 1099. To report, they use a K-1. So while you're getting it, the tax benefits flow through to you, but it's something that can potentially complicate your tax return.
Okay, and we don't want people to run into that situation.
Not if they don't have
to. REITs.
If they're public radio listeners, of course, they're smart enough to figure it out, of course. But if they'd rather not mess with it, right, Greg?
absolutely. I think the majority of the funds that you would buy out there would be a 1099 distribution. For REITs, the place you run into K-1s is typically if you own individual master limited partnerships in the pipelines and storage and so forth. But if there's two different mutual fund structures or ETFs that you can participate in, either a RIC fund or a 100% MLP fund that in most cases will be just 1099, and you won't have to worry about the K-1s there as well. So there's ways for investors to participate in the space and receive the good distribution income that you can get from those. from those underlying investments without being subject to the K-1s.
When you said a RIC fund, is that Rick Blaine as in Casablanca or another kind of RIC?
No, RIC is a 40 Act mutual fund where up to 25% of the underlying investments can be in master limited partnerships. And if they keep it less than 25%, then they still qualify just to send out investors a 1099.
Okay.
And not distribute K-1 income.
So it's always good to ask. What kind of yields are you looking at in that master limited partnership or gas pipeline space?
Sure. So if you look at the Alerian Index right now, right at 7%.
7%?
Yeah, 7%. So pretty healthy income right now in this low for long environment.
What's the trade-off, though? You get that higher interest rate, but what kind of risks are you taking on, Greg?
Well, we're talking about publicly traded equities, first of all. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we're talking about, master limited partnerships that are moving underlying commodities. So there can be some correlation between the underlying commodities of oil, natural gas, or natural gas liquids. And then we're talking a very narrow sector of just, a subset of energy, which could be just oil or just natural gas. So it can get pretty narrow at times. And when we get into these markets that are risk off, where investors are sort of running for the hills or looking for liquidity, they can come under more pressure than normally, fairly diversified S&P 500 positions. So that's probably the trade-off that comes to mind first and foremost.
Yeah. Greg, one of the other things that people have been looking at, two other instruments that have kind of caught the attention of the income-seeking marketplace are preferred shares of publicly traded preferred stocks individually or in a fund, mutual fund setting, opened or closed end, and also the so-called senior loans or the bank loan investments that don't have a fixed rate but are tied to some kind of floating rate. Have those spaces gotten too crowded, or is there still opportunity for a savvy income-seeking investor?
Yeah, I think it depends on your expectations. So, I think that, number one, there's no free lunch. And if we talk about buying preferred stocks, the majority of them issue at $25 a share. They're typically issued in many cases by the financial space, by the larger, money center banks, for example. So you can get some higher yields. But again, we're buying, preferred stocks. So they are stocks generating fixed income like distributions that pay quarterly in most cases. So there is an argument to be owning those. The one thing I'd be a little cautious about is as we get to a flatter yield curve where many banks take in deposits, as their funding source and then loan out longer term money as those margins shrink, in this environment, if we get to a flatter yield curve, some of those can come under pressure going forward. So although you can see some higher yields there, I think investors want to be cautious about, number one, owning preferred equities. And number two, if we're talking about the financials, they could come under some pressure here in their margins if the Fed continues to move up short-term rates and squeeze their margins a little bit. On the other side, on senior loans, I like senior loans in this environment. If your expectation is the coupon or the distribution coming off those, typically they tend to be high yield issued. So either double B or single B rated entities in that space. We're pretty fully valued in the senior loan space, but it's certainly a place to pick up some coupon, 3.5 to 4 and even higher percent right now taxable. But I like senior loans if the expectation is for the coupon in this environment, especially with the Fed moving rates up in the short term. That may, increase coupons here going forward, over the next, 15 or 18 months if the Fed moves up and as those existing deals get called and then they're reissued.
What about using common stocks that pay a dividend? I've seen yields, some of those running between 3 and 5%. What are the pros and cons of using a common stock as an income generator?
Yeah, looking at common stocks this year, it's interesting because large cap growth stocks are up, as of Friday, 16.6%. Mid cap growth stocks up 13.14%, and small cap growth stocks up 11.64%. Those are pretty significant returns, especially for retirees. So I think there's an argument to be in equities. If you look at large cap dividend paying value stocks, they're only up 5.38 this year. So again, I think you want to rely on your investment professional, but I think there's significant opportunities right now in equities. Cost of capital is still historically low to companies. especially with diversified income or diversified, you know, revenue sources to their balance sheet. Equities look good in here right now, and I think there's an argument for retirees, especially to outpace inflation over the long term. If inflation's only running at 2, you know, you're getting some good value there, not only to maintain the value of your portfolio here over the last year or so, but also to generate those yields that you talked about. I think the S&P yield right now is at 2 or 2.2. Right in that ballpark.
Just about two.
You can get even higher.
Yeah. Greg, what about tax-free bonds?
Municipal bonds?
Yeah, municipal bonds. Okay. That's been kind of silent lately. Are they still open?
Yeah.
Haven't heard much about them.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I hear about municipal bonds all the time. You know, they got very unappreciated back during right at the U.S. presidential election. I think bonds sold off pretty quickly, 6, 8, 9% for municipal bonds. And I think there's a good opportunity. I like that space. I hear from retirees and investors every week, you know, who should own them? I'm not in a high enough tax bracket to own them. But I tell you, the argument to have municipal bonds tied to a specific, you know, gas project, water, sewer project, bridge, toll road, I think that makes a lot of sense in this environment. I like the yields in municipal bonds. If you look at municipal bonds year to date, AAA munis have actually lagged or are almost right on AAA corporates this year. But high yield munis have provided really beautiful returns in the 8%+ range this year, much of it the coupon. But those look very, very good to me. I would say, you know, regardless of your tax bracket, taking a look at municipal bonds right now look intriguing to me, especially with overpriced U.S. corporate high yield issuers. But I like municipal bonds in this space a lot. And I like the opportunity to generate tax efficient income, you know, off those bonds. So I think that's a great place to be.
So Greg and Chris, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome. Absolutely.
Greg Brown, income strategist with Oppenheimer Funds, and Chris DeSimeo, financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. Listeners are reminded that the information provided on the show is general in nature and may not apply to your specific investment situation. Coming up, we'll talk with Francis Gary Powers Jr. about his father's ordeal in a Soviet prison. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.